Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
This is something that EPA has been taking the lead on for quite a while. They obviously are experienced in this area because they deal a lot with how you make sure that these kind of systems are taken care of and how you keep them properly doing their job. So the EPA has really been here for quite a while.
So USDA joining forces with EPA addressing issues associated with rural septic systems. Rural Utility Service Administrator Andrew Burke.
We have more recently started to get funding for decentralized water systems here at the USDA. This is something that Congress has entrusted us for, and this is a common issue in rural America. And so we're happy that we are now a signatory to this MOU.
This is Agriculture Today.
A lot of discussion and focus the last few months on the Panama Canal.
Dr. Guy Allen is director of the IGP Institute.
It's been a bit dry down there in the big lake, which sort of feeds their that water system where they lock it through the isthmus down there is low. So they've restricted drafts. A month or so ago, they started restricting the number that transit the canal. That's raised prices. And last month, they've put in slots. So now you have to go out and book and buy in a slot. And they're declining. And there's actually a secondary market that's evolved from that. So that's significantly increasing the price of any goods or commodities that have to transit that canal. Now, bringing that back to the U.S. from a grain commodities point of view, it hasn't had a major impact. It sort of changes the flow, but here domestically, grain commodity either moves off the West Coast, off the PNW, or it moves out of the U.S. Gulf. And we can change that flow very easily by what's been happening. The basis values at the Gulf have got fairly cheap relative to the PNW. So we're seeing rather than have to transit the canal, we just move our export flows from the western states to the PNW rather than to the center Gulf. So it's having an impact, but not as much as you might see. But it is quite bullish western basis values versus eastern Corn Belt basis values.
Definitely problems with the Panama Canal, but what about domestically?
Yeah, the Mississippi River is running low again this year, not quite as low as last year, but do have draft restrictions, I think at 10 or 10 and a half feet, which last year we saw barge freight rates well above 1,500% of tariff during gut slot harvest. This year, they were running about 600, and then about the middle of October, they dropped off pretty quickly. One was just the export demand wasn't showing up. Secondly, and probably the bigger issue is, growers, the prices had got low enough, growers just quit selling new crop corn. And we saw that in a two-day period in the barge freight market, where barge freight just went from 600 to about 300% of tariff. And it's going to be interesting to see the December stocks report, and I'd suggest we're going to see a lot more farmer-owned inventory here in the next stock report on that. So it's an issue, not as big an issue as it was last year, but it is a concern. Keep in mind about 75% of the water supply going down the lower Miss comes off the Ohio River. So we need some good rains in the eastern Corn Belt to really, really recharge that. It's also impacting the cost of fertilizers and other commodities coming back upriver for fall application and spring application of fertilizer, fuel, and those other commodities that move upriver on that logistics.
Dan O'Brien is a Kansas State grain economist.
Looking at the latest USDA Ag Transportation Report, we don't see a major jump yet, although a little bit of an increase in rail transportation costs, particularly for if we can't go down to the Gulf so well for these ag products. The next place we would go is probably up either through the St. Lawrence Seaway or mainly through the Pacific Northwest. And again, if those rates are jumping, at least with the indicators I'm seeing, I don't see it explosively jumping. But I would wonder about that. It's happening all that much worse, particularly as the Panama Canal issue prolongs itself. And there doesn't seem to be an end in sight.
And 2 weeks ago, we saw a big dry bulk rally.
We did see the dry bulk freight index double last week, at the end of last week, on the demand.
It did.
For more demand from dry bulk. That was probably coming more from coal and iron ore than grain itself. They all work together to drive those dry bulk vessel values. But last week, it essentially doubled in value in about 3 days. So particularly if you're reducing draft or if you're having to take alternative routes and increasing the distance, you need more capacity to basically fill that demand for that supply chain. It's come off a little bit in the last day, but that jump was rather, I guess, not surprising, but it happened very, very quickly.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Well, I think we're going into this with eyes wide open about the landscape, right? I think that, you know, this isn't going to be the farm bill to seek big sweeping changes to programs. It's not going to be the farm bill to seek a big sweeping increase in programs. This is going to be a farm bill, particularly for the cattle industry, but really for everybody, focused on holding together what you have.
Ethan Lane is Vice President of Government Affairs with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
With inflation being what it is, everything that was in the last farm bill is going to cost quite a bit more simply to maintain those programs. So just that on its face is going to be a 20% or so increase. So what was an $800 billion farm bill is now a $1 trillion farm bill just to keep pace with inflation in these programs. Never mind all of those different priorities that folks from every corner of agriculture are going to want to pay attention to, whether that's plussing up risk management programs or conservation programs or disaster assistance or making sure that there's adequate funding for things like the FMD vaccine bank. You know, all things that are really important to our producers and things that we're going to be advocating strongly for in this process. But, you know, always with an eye towards that idea that there are going to have to be some really difficult conversations, and a reminder that we're only 20% or so of this bill. You know, the lion's share is that nutrition title. And that is going to be where a lot of the fighting is going to happen between some of these more conservative members of the Republican Party in particular and Democrats who are really geared up to go down that path. So that's really going to be kind of a theme, I think, of this farm bill, is trying to preserve what you have and get through this process without anybody having to take a major haircut.
Although we won't see a new farm bill in 2023, next year we will see two farm bills emerge, one from the House and another from the Senate.
And I think that you're going to have subplots, you know, in between there. I have no doubt that at some point we'll see, you know, an effort at a Republican-only farm bill, right? Well, we'll just do it ourselves. You know, I mean, you're going to see different iterations of this throughout the course of the year. It's going to really be on G.T. Thompson's shoulders as the incoming chairman of the House Ag Committee, and Debbie Stabenow as the chairman of the Senate Ag Committee, and Congressman Bozeman, ranking member as well, to figure out how to navigate that, right? And to keep everybody's eye on the prize of putting together a bill that can win that broad bipartisan support. There are a lot of geographic differences, and there are a lot of different, priorities based on what part of the country folks come from. And that's going to be a big feature of this. I mean, it's a tightrope act. It's going to be really interesting to see them navigate. I know GT has said multiple times he's going to hit the ground running with hearings right out of the gate, and he plans to start that dialogue early. He's made a lot of progress moving around the country over the last 2 years, meeting with producers from coast to coast, gaining that knowledge base, understanding where the hot spots are, and I think it's going to serve him and his team well as they go through this process.
So how important will advocacy be?
There have been a lot of these incoming members, three or four at least, on the Republican side that have told us flat out they're not going to vote for a farm bill no matter what's in it. And these are members from ag states. So it's going to be a big education lift to help them understand the importance of the farm bill, the benefit that the farm bill provides to producers. And, you know, the cattle industry is in a different spot than other parts of agriculture. We don't have large-scale programs, price support programs or subsidy programs to protect in this bill. We're focused on voluntary stuff. We're focused on voluntary conservation programs, and we're focused on voluntary risk management programs and, tools like that. But nevertheless, those are important tools for our producers. So we're going to have to make sure we're in there really aggressively educating about the benefits of this bill and why it's so important to rural America.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I joined A&M about 5 years ago, or about 3.5 years ago, as his partner. So he and I are co-directors of the Ag and Food Policy Center. Prior to that, I spent 8.5 years in Washington, D.C. I was the chief economist of the House Ag Committee.
Dr. Bart Fisher is co-director of the Ag and Food Policy Center at Texas A&M.
First working for Chairman Lucas from Western Oklahoma on the 2014 Farm Bill, then staying on to work with Chairman Conaway on the 2018 Farm Bill. I worked on things like getting seed cotton added back to the farm bill back in 2018. And so after about 8.5 years, I got married and had 3 kids along the way, decided it was time to get them back to God's country. So we moved back to Texas. Prior to that, I'd done my PhD at A&M, but I grew up in southwestern Oklahoma, pretty much straight east of here on a dry land cotton farm. We grow cotton, wheat, cattle as well. Still pretty involved. Dad says I'm not that involved, but I like to think I'm pretty engaged back home still on the farm. try to stay pretty plugged in, but spend my days working at AFBC. I will say I teach about 186 undergraduate students on Tuesdays and Thursdays covering ag policy.
As many groups want to focus on reference prices in the new farm bill, Fisher says,
"We did this back in 2018. People looked at me like I had a horn growing out of my head when we did it at the time, thinking, well, this is never going to amount to anything. They're called effective reference prices. Some of you may have heard of them. Some of you may not. The way it works, and it's also a convoluted formula. Almost every convoluted formula you see coming out of Washington is because it was a budget compromise. That 85% factor you add onto PLC, budget compromise to get the budget where you needed it to be. On effective reference prices, it essentially looks back at prices. It says, hey, if prices have really floated up in the market, the reference price can float up with it. It can't float up, you know, we're going to use 85%. So we're going to look at 85% of the last 5-year prices. We use an Olympic average. If that's above the reference price, it can float up. But you know what? The budget dictated it couldn't go more than 15%. So they're allowed to float up 15%. At the time, a whole lot of, well, that's ridiculous. What a waste of money. It's designed to do the sort of thing we're talking about now, though. Maybe cost needs to be an element of it. But if you look at what has happened, and you probably can't read the numbers. If you can make out the colors, that's the main thing. You know, this first column is the statutory reference price. Corn, $3.70. Soybeans, $8.40. Wheat, $5.50. Seed cotton, $36.70. The sorts of things that are written in statute. If 85% of that market price gets above that, it can start floating up. So if you see the green, it means it's floated up, but by less than 15%. So you haven't reached, this is the cap, 115% of that number. So green means it's floating up, but it hasn't reached this number. Red means it's floating up, but it's going to be capped at that number. It's above the limitation. And so in a lot of cases with where market prices have been, you know, there's a lot of chatter about we need to increase the reference prices and inflate the reference prices. That's already happening under current law. To me, this is another good thing because we shouldn't have to pay for this again. This is already in current law allowing them to float up. And you may say, well, what about our part of the world? They're not floating up. Well, if you look at more recent, we'll get an update from CBO here pretty soon. If you look at more recent data, RMA's long-term outlook from November, I use that on wheat as an example. So this red line was from the previous chart. If you had seen on wheat, it got up to about 549, but the statutory reference price is 550. So you're thinking, well, effective reference prices don't do anything. If USDA's most recent outlook holds in the CBO projections, that's where the wheat reference price would go midstream of this next farm bill. So for folks wanting to get above the 550, it could already be going to 633 just under current law without making any changes. Granted, it won't stay there. The key here is that you don't have to pay for that again. So to me, it's also a very good thing because it should provide some credit against this interest in raising reference prices. And we'll see in the new update whether cotton fits or not.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
With support from USDA and the American Lamb Board, the U.S. Meat Export Federation held a seminar showcasing U.S. lamb for importers and distributors from throughout Mexico. Gary Pfeiffer, Executive Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Superior Farms, shares his thoughts on the seminar.
It was a terrific event that the team in Mexico put together, so we're really excited to be able to participate in the event. The event was held at the El Cielo Winery in the wine region of Ensenada, Mexico, so it was just a beautiful setting and had distributors and influencers from throughout Mexico that came in for the event. You know, started off with a seminar and a demonstration. Each of the representatives from the U.S. So we gave a presentation about American lamb and our company and our products, which was really well received, and we got a lot of good questions. And then from there, we had a terrific lunch, and then really spent the afternoon networking with the different distributors throughout Mexico.
Pfeiffer was especially impressed with the turnout of buyers representing Mexico's food service sector.
Mexico has always been an important export destination for us. But, you know, for us, what was really exciting about it was this really introduced us to a lot more distributors and, most importantly, a much better understanding of the food service scene in Mexico. So for us, that's where we see our greatest growth potential. after our discussions and, you know, talking about our products and seeing the quality of it and understanding more about what their needs are and what our capabilities are, there's certainly an opportunity for growth throughout Mexico with American Lamb. They were very excited to hear that we offered a fresh option, because I think they're used to getting primarily frozen meat from overseas. So really being our next door neighbor and the availability of fresh lamb was very exciting to them. One of our taglines is 10,000 miles fresher, and that seemed to really resonate with the group that was there.
I'm John Harris.
Thanks, John. Well, let's turn now from exports to estate tax. The death tax. Chad Smith reports.
The American Farm Bureau Federation was part of a letter to Congress expressing opposition to the estate tax. Dustin Shearer, Director of Government Affairs for the American Farm Bureau, talks about what was in the letter.
The Family Business Estate Tax Coalition, of which American Farm Bureau Federation is a member, sent a letter to Representatives Steenstra and Bishop, who plan on introducing the Death Tax Repeal Act in the House, hopefully sometime in mid-January. Farm Bureau has long been opposed to any type of estate tax, and this particular bill would take the estate tax completely off the books.
The large number of groups signed on to the letter, including those that represent a variety of businesses outside of agriculture, shows how important the issue is to the overall economy.
It's very indicative of how important it is to small, privately held, family-owned businesses, farms, ranches. The estate tax is oftentimes talked about only with reference to somebody with a farm or a ranch trying to pass down a business from one generation to the next. But you apply those same principles to a family-owned small business that manufactures products or a family-owned construction company.
The American Farm Bureau has long been an outspoken opponent of the death tax.
For some reason, somebody at some point in history thought that somebody dying was a good enough reason to levy a tax on all of the assets that they had accumulated. We have always been philosophically just opposed to that. This particular tax makes it very difficult to transition a business from one generation to the next, which in many cases is all families want to do, is keep the family in the business. It's provided for the family over the course of one generation. They want to make sure that it's there for the next.
Chad Smith, Washington.
And with a comprehensive look at agribusiness news, markets, and weather, it's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I am pleased that this committee is not directed against China.
Earlier this year, Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, on the creation of a House Select Subcommittee on the strategic competition between the U.S. and China.
But is directed against the Chinese Communist Party in the crafting of the language. And I am pleased that it's going to focus on things that have been a bipartisan concern. Human rights violations that Representative McGovern has advocated in standing up to the Uyghurs. The fact that this country has lost our industrial base. For 40 years, on a bipartisan basis, we watched as jobs were shipped offshore, factories shut down, our trade deficits going from $70 billion to almost $400 billion. That has hurt the working class. It's hurt our ability to be a superpower, and it has led to rising tensions with China. If we want to deal with Asian hate in this country, one of the things we need to do is rebalance our production. It's the loss of our jobs that has fueled some of the xenophobia. It's the loss of those jobs that fueled the killing that Representative Chu talked about in Michigan with Vincent Chang. I believe this committee can not only stand up for American interests, I believe when done well, it can help get us to peace and reduce the tensions with China by rebalancing trade, by ensuring that China doesn't invade Taiwan, and by standing up for human rights.
And sweeping wide bipartisan support, indicated by French Hill from Arkansas.
The title is fundamental here. This is a policy dispute between our government and the Chinese Communist Party. Not China, not the Chinese people. Most Americans have great affinity for the Chinese people, their industriousness, technical talent, both in China and as citizens abroad. And the United States has a long history of partnership with China in the 19th century as a partner in trade, during World War II as an ally, and our support of their growth over the past five decades. But today, as a great power and as an ancient civilization, China has been perverted by the modern leadership of Leader for Life, Xi, and the CCP. Sadly, this has been manifested by rampant intellectual property theft, overburdening developing nations through corrupt credit practices, manipulation of the facts in Wuhan, punishment of religious thought, and the collapse of the rule of law in one of the freest places on the globe, Hong Kong, and perhaps most offensively, genocide of the Uyghurs and others. During the pandemic, we have witnessed the severe vulnerability of the world's global supply chain as being far too reliant on China for minerals, for pharmaceuticals, for medical supplies, for almost everything. This select committee will work to address the possible strategies and meet and counter Xi's posture.
Florida Representative Michael Waltz.
We have the cornering of critical supply chains and dependencies on China that is being done deliberately as they steal their way to the top through our intellectual property, spying on the Federal Reserve, flooding our key institutions, including academia, with money, buying up farmland. Mr. Chairman, this is a whole of government, whole of society challenge that we have never before faced in American history.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We do this in the lab every year. We just look at what happened in 2022, and it just so happened this week or last week we finished summarizing the major things that we find that are causing abortions in the Midwest.
Dr. Greg Hanselcheck is Kansas State veterinarian on the top causes of cattle abortions. He also talks about safe labels.
There's four or five vaccines out there that are labeled to use in pregnant cows, and it's safe, but those cows had to have had the same product within the previous 12 years. And the case we were talking about just came in today, and we'll find out if it's actually true, but this person bought 39 cows, unknown vaccination history. He always gives his pregnant cows a modified live vaccine at this time of year. So he ran everybody through, gave modified live. That was last week. And now today he had 10 abortions, and it's probably going to have more. And it's all out of those cows where the unknown vaccination history. So yeah. The neat thing about the diagnostic lab, I think we're one of the few diagnostic lab that can do this, but they're going to submit some of the aborted fetuses. And if we find IBR, we can gene type it, and we can tell the producer and the veterinarian and say, this is vaccine virus, or we can say, it's not vaccine virus. This is a field exposure, and it's really good to know which source it's coming from.
He also says, pay attention to mold.
We think of molds, well, we think the cow consumes it through the hay or the silage or whatever, but really most of the infections occur because they inhale it, and then it gets into their lungs, and then it goes what we call systemic, which just means it gets in the blood system, and then it goes into the fetus and causes some major issues. So it can be both ingestion, but most of it's inhaled.
So when it comes to avoiding molds, like you said, sometimes it's not avoidable in some cases, but when it comes to doing your best to do so, what are some best practices there?
Well, if at all possible, if you've got bales of hay that have that white mold where you're unrolling them or putting them through the processor and you see that dust, I know it's not always possible, but if at all possible, try to use those bales on young stock. Try to stay away from anything that's moldy going into pregnant cows, whether it's silage or whether it's hay or anything. That's probably the best thing you can do. You're never going to prevent all mold in any of our feedstuffs. One of the biggest cases we ever had was a producer that brought in multiple tons of range cubes, or what we called cake, and housed it in a facility where moisture got to it. And that cake became moldy, and then when he fed it to his pregnant heifers, there was a major, major abortion storm. So it can be in products that you purchase if they're not stored correctly also.
And just a gentle reminder that if your herd gets this, call the vet immediately.
It's very frustrating, whether it's our laboratory or the other laboratories across the United States that monitor this. From year to year, it's about 30% of the time we can say we know exactly what caused this abortion. And it is frustrating for everybody, including the pathologists, the veterinarians, and the producers. But if there is an abortion storm, one of the things is call the veterinarian, because there are specific samples, in particular the placenta, which are extremely valuable to help us find a diagnosis. And a lot of times we don't have a diagnosis because the organism's gone. It came in and did its damage, and now the IBR is left. Sometimes it's just such a quick disease thing that there's nothing in the tissues that we look at that recognize it as a disease. And so there's a whole bunch of reasons why we can't always find what the cause of the abortion is. And then in a typical year when we have an abortion storm, it's rare that we're thinking about how we're going to prevent it this year. But we need to know so that we can try to prevent it the next year and the next year and the next year. So that's really the goal.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
What are the market prospects for the nation's pork producers?
There isn't a lot to say about pork right at this point.
By that now, USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski says his team of analysts don't want to change the basics of their previous pork-related forecasts until after USDA releases its quarterly hogs and pigs inventory report. That comes on the 22nd. But checking on what they have been saying up to now, it looks like for 2024, pork production and hog prices both will be higher than this year. On the price side,
prices are expected to be up year over year. For our 2023 prices, forecast at $58.70 per hundredweight. That's expected to increase to $60 per hundredweight in 2024.
This 2% higher price coming even with a projected 2% increase in pork output next year. Gary Crawford, Washington.